We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Welcome to World Soccer Talk Radio here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. Fresh week, fresh start. Good to be here with you. My name is Nate Abarea. Tweet me at NateWST. Follow all of us at World Soccer Talk. What a weekend. What a weekend all over the footballing world, all over the soccer world, the Calcio world, whatever world you're living in, if it has a little round ball and 22 men or women chasing it. What a weekend. The U.S. women's national team, Mexico, Argentina, England, Italy, Spain, Northern California. I soaked it all in. I traveled everywhere in my own mind this weekend. A lot of it centered around the Premier League, where everyone is talking now about that Dele Alli goal, that Tottenham strike that ended up being the match winner at Selhurst Park against Crystal Palace. That Dele Alli goal, talking about it as one of the world goals of the year. And I'm back here in Northern California thinking, oh, come on, let's not get over the top here. It wasn't even the goal of the weekend. That has to go to a 25-yard thunderbolt volley from Kobe Vara for the Shasta Wolfpack JV squad, who defeated Red Bluff 7-0. On Friday afternoon up in Redding, California. 8-0-0, by the way. Big piece of information. Now you guys are dying to know the record right now. 8-0-0. Four more matches to go. We shall see what our Shasta Wolfpack boys can accomplish. But no, in all honesty, Dele Alli with one of the goals of the year in the Premier League. One of the best goals I've seen in a year or so. Spurs are flying. The legend of Klopp's glasses. I mean, the 5-4 victory for Liverpool at Carrow Road against Norwich. And I'm telling you, as a Liverpool fan, whether it's Luis Garcia drinking sangria, Luis Suarez scoring hat tricks, or this incredible 5-4 victory in the legend of Kloppy's glasses, I love when Liverpool play on the road at Norwich. It's the house of beautiful things. And how about the Super Clásico down in Argentina, the first edition of it here in 2016? Boca and River in a preseason match with a 20-man brawl and three red cards. You gotta love it. Hope you enjoyed your footballing weekend, and we've got a very special treat for you to open up this week. Shaka Hislop is going to be with us. That's right, the former Trinidad and Tobago and West Ham goalkeeper with us on the other side of this break. Cannot wait to get talking with Shaka. Why don't you stick around? World Soccer Talk Radio. Right down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Welcome back to World Soccer Talk Radio here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We'll get Shaka Hislop on the line with us here as soon as possible. And we're actually going to be talking with Shaka all about what West Ham are doing these days and exciting times ahead for one of his former clubs, a club that he has a great affection for to this day. We've talked with Shaka about that quite a bit on this show before. And it's funny because there's certain players who Craig Burley is one who actually comes to mind, one of Shaka's co-workers over there at ESPN FC, another great friend of the show. And Craig is quite candid when he talks about relationships with former teams. And Craig is someone who played for Chelsea for almost 10 years, played for Celtic for a substantial period of time in his career as a proud Scotsman. And it's funny, Craig's one of those guys who says, Nate, you know, I'm not trying to be a jerk here, but I have to be honest, I don't really have any added affection or devotion or loyalty to Chelsea as a pundit, as a broadcaster, a writer, whatever it may be. I don't have any loyalty to Chelsea any more than I do to Manchester United or Crystal Palace or Grimsby Town or Crawley or Swansea. I mean, the point being that, and even Celtic, he said even his time at Celtic, where he enjoyed himself greatly, where he has nothing but good things to say about the time that he spent in Glasgow playing for Celtic. He says, I really don't actually have any level of loyalty to Celtic over Rangers, over Aberdeen, over any other team in Scotland or any other team in the world for that matter. And I bring that up because the juxtaposition here is fascinating, because you get guys who are former pros like Craig, who not to say that they weren't giving their all for their teams, but they just, they don't have that level of lifelong connection. that some players end up having with certain clubs. And I have to say, shock of his lot, funny enough, is for me and in all of my experience talking with ex-professionals and guys who've been around the game for decades plus, Shaka is someone who has great loyalty to West Ham. And I don't know what exactly it was. I mean, I wasn't a fly on the wall at Upton Park during his time there, but from everything that I've heard from him, I can be led to believe that he was treated incredibly well, that he also has an amazing amount of respect and appreciation for Harry Redknapp, the man who signed him at West Ham when he was a youngster, and had the faith in, this is back before, you know, foreign goalkeepers were such a commonplace in English football, but having faith in this man from the Caribbean, you know, being a Premier League goalkeeper. And so it's interesting because I have such great respect for both of these men that I'm bringing up, and we've had both of them on the show multiple times. And I just think it's so funny that Shaka has got this incredible loyalty to West Ham and everything that is the Hammers. And I can't wait to talk with Shaka about West Ham moving forward and his thoughts on the new Olympic Stadium and saying bye to the Bowling Ground, Upton Park, and everything that the fans are going through right now. A lot of people making this really interesting comparison of West Ham to Tottenham right now and where Tottenham have gone under Mauricio Pochettino over the last couple of seasons. And my God, what they're doing right now, developing a hell of a lot of momentum in the Premier League. Look out for Tottenham in this wide open race for the top four, where we're still throwing out Leicester City as a potential title winner in the Premier League. Look out for Spurs. That's all I'm going to say, especially with Dele Alli working his magic and everybody else doing their things as well. But there's so many bright things to look forward to for West Ham, and a lot of people are comparing them to Tottenham right now and saying that it's actually going to be West Ham who are going to be the London club to compete with the likes of Arsenal and Chelsea. They're going to be the London club that are going to be right up there in terms of worldwide exposure, as far as the money that's going to start flowing in through ticket sales, through being more marketable, through playing in this Olympic stadium with a bigger capacity and all that goes with that on so many different levels. And, you know, tomorrow we have the great pleasure of having a very distinguished guest with us who his name is Steve Parrish. We have in tomorrow's show, we have the chairman of Crystal Palace with us. So talk about the advancement of London soccer and football in the city of London, all these clubs that are doing the right things and taking advantage of the new money flowing in to the Premier League, taking advantage of the television deals, taking advantage of new stadiums, of foreign investment, all these things. And so I love what's going on at West Ham. I love what's going on at Tottenham. I love what's going on at Crystal Palace. And we'll be talking specifically about the West Ham subject with Shaka Hislop as soon as we get him on the line. And again, tomorrow, be sure to tune in for that one. A very exciting conversation coming up with Crystal Palace chairman Steve Parrish, a man who rescued that club 6 years ago from administration, helped them escape bankruptcy. And although they are going through a bit of a rough patch in the Premier League right now, you compare it to where Crystal Palace were 6 years ago. And again, this progression of London football here in the new millennium, it's some fascinating, fascinating stuff. Getting word that we do indeed have Shaka Hislop on the line. Shaka, are you there, sir?
I certainly am. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing mighty fine. So I can't wait to talk with you all about your beloved Hammers, about your former side and everything going on with West Ham. But I have to ask you before we get into anything, the last time that we had you on the show was back in August. And we said that you actually said that in your next ESPN contract, you were hoping to work out a clause that got you some kind of bonus each time you had to deal with the disturbing flatulence in the room from a coworker. Have you worked anything like that out in a new contract?
No, not quite just yet. The my lawyers are looking at it though, because it's a health hazard as well.
Well, we've got Stevie Nichol on the show on Friday, so I'll be sure to pass that along.
Please do, please, yes.
All right, let's get right into the Hammers and everything going on with your former club right now. Let's focus in the immediate. First off, I assume you had a chance to watch the match this weekend and the exciting 2-2 draw with Manchester City, where West Ham, quite frankly, were unlucky at the end to not get all 3 points. It was an incredible game. But take us through your thoughts of this past weekend for the Hammers with the match against City.
But it didn't surprise me all that much to see West Ham perform as well as they did against City. I mean, we all know that City have been incredibly inconsistent. But West Ham, more to the point, against teams like City, I think have fared well. You saw that early on in the season with how well they started on the road, when teams allow them to play. I think they're a match for anybody. And what Slaven Bilic has done, or the team he has assembled, is a team that can play in a number of different ways. They can be direct with Andy Carroll when he's fit. I know he wasn't on the weekend. But when you have the likes of Valencia on the park and Asako when he's available, it's a team that can hit you with a lot of pace, a lot of good movement. They have a solid midfield anchored by none other than Mark Noble, who made his debut when I was at West Ham and started establishing himself as a Hammer that long ago. And it's a team that I think is as complete as we've seen for quite some time.
I want to ask you something here, actually taking a step away from the immediate here and talking about something with your West Ham career, because I talked about this a few minutes ago, and it's something that really fascinates me, because you have this great affection and great love for West Ham as a club, as a team that you played for. And it's actually another one of your co-workers at ESPN FC named Craig Burley is among, and Craig's not the only one, where guys play for certain teams throughout their career. They'll play upwards of 10 years for a team, and then when they're post-career, when they're a pundit, they're a broadcaster, a writer, whatever it may be, they don't really have loyalty for that team over Manchester United or over a lower division side. It's quite to the contrary for you. You do definitely have a great affection and loyalty, seemingly, to West Ham. Talk about what it was in your time there that made it that way, because you played for other teams as well. You know, what was it about your time at West Ham that carries on something in your heart to this day?
Well, it was just the time when I played, and probably a lot to do with it was who I played under and Harry Redknapp. West Ham are a club that, well, certainly I came there from Newcastle, that there was a lot of expectation, and there wasn't that at West Ham. And the philosophy, which is a much-used phrase, it was a rather simple one. Enjoy your football and play to the Ron Greenwood style, which is, they wanted to enter ball and getting results. You had to kind of appreciate the finer details of the game in terms of how the game was played on the floor, fast paced, and one that the fans could get behind. And the fans bought into that as well. And you saw it a couple of seasons ago when Sam Allardyce, remember, he complained after a game that West Ham actually won, and the crowd booed because they didn't like the style. And that's kind of, it kind of reflected my own upbringing in the game, playing in Trinidad and Tobago, where, all right, maybe because of the temperature and the climate there, the game wasn't just all about kick and rush. It wasn't just all high tempo. It was a lot more methodical. It had a lot more tactics to it back then. And I just felt that my time at West Ham and the way they played and the way they were expected to play reflected my own roots in the game, and I just enjoyed my professional football.
Well, you brought up the name Harry Redknapp, and that's something I want to talk with you on the other side of this break. Shaka Hislop, alongside yours truly, Nate Abarea, talking a little Harry on the other side right here on World Soccer Talk Radio, Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. All right. right, picking up right where we left off, Nate Abarrea here with Shaka Hislop on World Soccer Talk Radio and talking a little Harry Redknapp, the man that signed Shaka Hislop when he first came to West Ham. And Shaka, I throw it to you right now because you touched on something really interesting there in terms of his philosophy and how much you embraced it and how much it in many ways tied in with the overall philosophy of West Ham as a club going back decades upon decades. And there's always this conception, though, with Harry Redknapp, whether it was his time at West Ham or a number of other clubs that we don't have enough time to give the full list right here, but there's always this conception that man management was his forte and how he got the best out of his players through man management. But there's always this kind of knock on him that he wasn't as tactically astute, shall we say, as other managers. Kind of that idea of just telling the players to go out there and play their best and love the game of football, embrace every minute out there, soak it all up, and let the players sort out the decisions on the pitch. What did you see as far as that kind of discussion goes, as far as his strengths of man management and maybe some of his lackings in terms of the tactics? What did you see as far as that discussion when you played under him?
Well, I think you kind of summed it up there, Nate. I mean, it's exactly as you described. Harry Redknapp was a fantastic man manager, though not a great tactician. But then look at the team, look at the success he had. Look at the types of players that he signed. At West Ham, for instance, he signed Paolo Di Canio when nobody would touch him. An absolute genius on the park. He signed Ian Wright. He signed Reza Ruddock, Davos Suka. These are the types of players that I think Harry did so well with. Players who knew the game and wanted the opportunity or a last opportunity, as it may be in the case of Abdava Suka and Ian Wright, to go out and prove their worth when others were asking them to fit into a certain system and maybe they couldn't or didn't want to or didn't appreciate what that system was. You could come and you play under Harry Redknapp, know that you'd be surrounded with wonderfully talented players and allowed to express yourself. I mean, not just those players that are mentioned. I think most listeners would recognize. But you had players like Trevor Sinclair. We had Mark Vivian Foy, who passed on a few years later. Ian Pearce, Stuart Pearce at the back. It made for fantastic footballing teams. I was also at West Ham when Harry Redknapp gave Joe Cole his debut. And his instructions to Joe were simple. Go sit in behind the striker and enjoy yourself. That's all he asked of Joe. We knew what was expected of Joe. We knew he wasn't going to come back to defend. And we had players who were good enough, who understood the game well enough to compensate and to adjust to suit. And I still feel that was Joe's best football at West Ham at his earliest under Harry Redknapp, where he was just allowed to express himself and do as he felt. And that's exactly what Harry did. Great talents on the park and allowed them to make their own minds up, trust in their own instincts on the field and make the right decisions. And it was wonderfully successful. And at the same time, it was a lot of fun to be a part of.
Shaka, we had a laugh about this off the air the last time you were on the show, and I have to, because this transitions perfectly, I have to share this with the listeners right now. First English football match that I ever attended. I was 8 years old, and it was back in the year 1999 at Villa Park in Birmingham on a Monday night. It was West Ham taking on Villa in April of 1999. You were the starting goalkeeper for that match. Frank Lampard, Rio Ferdinand, and Joe Cole were all youngsters out on the pitch that night. Villa Park packed back in the day. It was absolutely packed. Amazing atmosphere on a Monday night. And you know what the best part of the story is, Shaka? You had a clean sheet. 0-0 draw. I didn't get a goal in the first ever match that I attended in England, but I did get something even better. Of course, a Shaka Hislop shutout.
Well, I, as it happens, Nate, that season, we did quite well. If you look at the stats, our stats were shocking. I think we had like a +4 goal difference or something short. But I actually kept the second most clean sheets that season after David Seaman. David Seaman had 19, and I think I had 17 or 15, so somewhere around there. West Ham had, if memory serves me correctly, more clean sheets than Peter Schmeichel and Manchester United at the time. And that was the treble-winning season of Manchester United. What we did do, though, was when we conceded a lot. And that, again, kind of just goes into how we played the game. If we went behind, we were going to chase and we were going to go for it. We never mind just limiting the damage. We were going to go all out and trying to get ourselves back. But, yeah, so clean sheets were a thing we enjoyed. But when we didn't keep them, we were in for an exciting roller coaster, whichever way. Unfortunately, Nate, you picked one of the few nil-nils we had that season.
Well, you know what? I'll never forget, Shaka, being a little kid, and I was in the Holt End, too. So, I mean, you can imagine how overwhelming the massive Holt End at Villa Park was. I'm this little kid. There's punch-ups going on around me. There's all the songs and all the anger flying around in the air. And it was the second half with Villa attacking the Holt End. And I actually remember a play that involved you, and it was Dion Dublin playing up front for Aston Villa at the back post on this play where you kind of got wrong-footed going over to cover one post, and the ball nicked off somebody, went back, and Dion Dublin had the entire goal to work with. And I still, to this day, Dion Dublin, one of the great goal scorers of that generation, did so much good. I still don't know what the hell he was doing, but he threw this bizarre kind of like twisting karate kick at the ball when he could have just tapped it right in. He somehow puts it wide. And I remember that was like a great introduction to the life of a goalkeeper, because I still to this day remember I was close enough to see the expression on your face going, oh, wow, like we just got away with that? Awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know Dion very well. One of the great players and one of the great gentlemen of the game, I have to say. And yeah, you don't give Dion a lot. You know, you certainly didn't. And a lot of times, I as a goalkeeper, you know who's around you. And when the ball falls to certain players, you kind of know what to expect and know what's coming. And you have to adjust. So it's different for different players. But you give Dion half a chance and it's going to end up your feet is going to end up in the back of the net, whichever way. He was strong in the air, had two great feet. So I get myself in a muddle and you look over and you see Dion doubling, the ball's falling to Dion doubling. And you're just waiting on the crowd just to cheer. And all that. That's, that's what's about to come next. And you're just kind of going through the emotions till that. And to see Dion miss it it's a rare thing, and you count your blessings. You get the ball moving again as quickly as possible, just to make sure it's not a dream, or the referee doesn't give him a do-over, and you're thanking lucky stars.
Without a doubt. Hey, Shaka, we've only got about a minute and a half before we got to head to break, but I love looking back on this. It was such a special night for me. And again, those players, I love that you brought up Joe Cole and talked about the freedom that Cole had as a youngster under Harry Redknapp. But when you look at Frank Lampard and Joe Cole in particular, and even Rio Ferdinand as well in that team, did you have any idea watching those guys as youngsters that they would be as great as they ended up being? They would all end up being pretty much legends of their generation?
But early on, you always felt that Joe Cole and Rio would go on to do great things. Frank was actually told early on that he was not good enough to make it at West Ham. His dad was the assistant coach at West Ham, and Frank developed a work ethic off the back of that rejection that is second to none. Frank worked tirelessly. During practice, he would stay back after practice, working on his striking with both feet, working on his fitness, working on his runs, on his sprinting, got himself into a physical shape, and worked himself into greatness. It's the only way you can express it. Whereas Rio and Joe had a lot more natural talent. And I, being there for 4 years, when these guys were coming through, I had a ringside seat to see exactly how they progressed. And Frank's focus, Frank's single-mindedness, again, for me, is second to none. It's something that I hear a lot of people speak about with Cristiano Ronaldo. And I know Dwight York, and he played at Manchester United with Cristiano, and he says the same things about Cristiano. I saw that in Frank. So to see Frank achieve the things that he did and play as long as he did, didn't come as a surprise when you see the time he put in at the training ground. Rio, on the other hand, was always blessed with natural talent. I actually heard Rio on the radio defending John Stones and some of his mistakes and said it was a part of the learning process. And I saw that. Again, I had a front row seat to that as a player. I probably picked the ball out of the back of the net a few times because of some of Rio's mistakes.
Hey, Shaka, let's continue. Let's definitely continue this here on the other side of the break. We're back after this. World Soccer Talk Radio, Shaka Hislop and yours truly, Nate Abarrea. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show, World Soccer Talk Radio, here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. Tweet us your take on this episode at World Soccer Talk and find me, Nate Abarrea, at NateWST, Shaka Hislop, alongside yours truly for this one. And I want to talk with you now, Shaka, about something that relates to Harry Redknapp. Well, it relates directly to Harry Redknapp, but it's something that you touched on as far as we're talking all about these youngsters and going back in the memory banks and talking about playing with the young Joe Cole and young Frank Lampard and young Rio Ferdinand at West Ham. But you also touched on what Harry did for guys at the end of their careers at West Ham and obviously at so many other clubs, the likes of Davor Suker, the likes of Ian Wright. And it's funny that I was just thinking about this during the break is that Harry signed you again in England late on in your career at Portsmouth. I mean, so it actually holds true with you as well. He brought you in when you were a younger goalkeeper. He brought you in towards the end of your career as well. I mean, talk about a relationship like that where a guy as a manager is with you kind of throughout multiple stages of your career and how that relationship was built.
Yeah, it really was wonderful, and the expectation was different in playing for Harry at West Ham than it was at Portsmouth. Now, we came into West Ham, a young and exciting team. We finished fifth that season. That is still West Ham's highest ever Premier League finish. I'm hoping that West Ham can at least equal that, if not better this time around. But that's another discussion, maybe for another day. And we had this one. We had fantastic experience and youth, as you mentioned. And as long as we played the game in the way that the fans were expected, and we enjoyed it, that was all that was ever asked of us. At Portsmouth, it was a different challenge. I actually joined Harry at Pompey. Pompey were in what is now the Championship. It was the first division. It was branded as the first division at the time. And Portsmouth had been in the midst of a terrible run. I think in the 10 years previous, or at least 17 times, seven times in the previous 10 seasons, Pompey had only managed to finish above 15th, I think, in League One. And I mean, that's how mired in that division Portsmouth were at the time. And Harry brought me in at the later stages of my career. He brought the likes of Paul Merson in to strengthen that squad. Steve Stone, he brought down from Aston Villa. And again, it was a team that had a lot of experience in it and a lot of good players in it, and maybe at the back end of their careers, and a lot of young talent coming through. We ended up winning the first division that season and then went on, the next two while I was there, managed to survive in the Premier League. And Harry then moved on and came back eventually, which part I had already left and probably retired at which point. I only played another year after I left Pompey. But it was, again, a gift of Harry, just kind of knowing the right pieces for the puzzle that he was trying to build and allowing talented players to come in and just enjoy their football and trust in their instincts on the field.
Do you think he is done managing on the touchline, being a proper football manager in England? Has his time run out, or do you see him potentially managing in the Premier League again?
I think his time has run out. I just feel that now it's been a little bit too long for Harry, that he's been out of the game. The game has moved on, and I think the game benefits from new and fresh ideas. Maybe he comes in and serves in some backroom capacity, while I was playing for Harry, he had Jim Smith as his assistant, who was there on the training field, was another experienced head that a lot of the players could could go to, could lean on, that a lot of the staff could go to and lean on. Maybe Harry plays that kind of role in the latter stages of his own footballing career, as it were. But as a head coach or the first team manager, I'd be surprised if I saw Harry on that touchline again.
Well, definitely. And by the way, I encourage everybody to go out and check out our good friend Graham Hunter's two-part interview with Harry Redknapp through the Big Interview series. Some phenomenal stuff within that. And also go check out the Graham Hunter episode of World Soccer Talk Radio from last week while you're at it. But cheers to Harry Redknapp, whether he manages in the top flight in England again or not. An absolute legend of the game. And many people, I'm sure, would echo some of the words that Shaka has just shared here on the show today. All right, we got to jump right back to West Ham because it's such a special season for so many reasons. The main one being the football being played and the chances to accomplish something truly great. And we'll get to that stuff here in a few moments. But I have to ask you about the special sense of this season with it being the last at the Bowling Ground, with it being the last season at Upton Park, a place that is obviously near and dear to your heart, Shaka. What are you going to miss the most about Upton Park? And what are perhaps some of your greatest memories at Upton Park that stand out to this day?
Wow, I'm going to miss the kick and run. Well, not that kick and run is in existence in the way it was in my first spell at West Ham, but it was the section that nobody really wanted to go in front of and play in front of. I remember I played at Upton Park, and this is before it was redeveloped, where the stands were very close to the side of the pitch. The chicken run was kind of notorious for how kind of volatile the fans were. I've played games there where the ball would be sitting on the sideline for the opposition to throw, and nobody from the opponents would want to go over and take a throw. And the ball would just sit there, and everybody would just be kind of looking over, kind of saying, well, no, you take it. No, I'm not going over there, type of thing. And we would just always raise a laugh from everybody. And I think once the Upton Park was redeveloped, the stands pushed back probably 6 or 7 yards from the touchline, all around the park, and it seemed to lose a little bit of the atmosphere, and it definitely lost a lot of the intimidation factor that came with playing at Upton Park. So that has changed. As far as some of my best memories, I don't know. We had some fantastic times, I have to say, especially in that first spell at West Ham. Where the football was so great, we had fantastic characters as well in that dressing room that made it a special place. And then I came back 2005-2006, played under Alan Pardew, and as I said, the ground had been redeveloped. I think the atmosphere at Upton Park, as I mentioned, lost a little something. But then we went on that amazing FA Cup run, which don't get me talking about the final just yet, Nate. I'm still getting counselling over that 2006 FA Cup final. And the whole place erupted around how well the team was playing. This was the team had just been promoted that season, so everybody expected us to do a little more than just survive. We were very near to the top five and top six all the way to the end of the season. I think we ended up finishing ninth, but that was mainly due to our FA Cup run where we simply lost focus of what we were doing in the league. And it really was a special season as well. I'd love to win that FA Cup, not just, you know, for personal accomplishment, but I feel it's the least that the West Ham fans deserve.
Well, I apologize for doing this, but the next match in the cup for West Ham will be against Liverpool at Upton Park. So I'm sorry to just spit out the facts on that one. But what do you think are going to be the keys for West Ham to defeat the Jurgen Klopp led Reds in the cup this upcoming weekend?
But I honestly think West Ham just have to keep doing what they're doing. I'm not at all convinced by Liverpool this season, and this is not a slight or meant as a slight of Jurgen Klopp, a manager who I have a tremendous respect for. But even if you look at Liverpool's game on the weekend, defensively, I just feel that Liverpool are still looking for an identity and still trying to figure out exactly what they're doing, exactly what Jürgen Klopp is trying to get out of them. And appears a little bit fractured. Whereas you look at West Ham, and you know what you're going to get from this team. Slaven Bilic knows this team now, and I think he has this team playing pretty much how he wants them to play. That they understand their defensive roles, and they also understand the different ways that they can approach attacking this game. And now, I feel as a result, West Ham are in a far better place than Liverpool are. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Nate, the one thing West Ham are very good at is being exciting and taking games to the opponents when the opponents themselves come out to play. And that's what Liverpool are going to do. And it's going to allow West Ham space to move room in behind for the likes of Valencia, a midfield that Payet continues to amaze in. And I think this is exactly the type of game that West Ham are at their best. And I see them getting 3 points.
Well, and advancing to the next round, exactly, in the cup, and then they took it to Liverpool back when they played. You know what was funny is this just came to mind. The last time we actually had you on the show, Shaka, it was Liverpool West Ham a day later. So now it'll be Liverpool West Ham a few days later. I don't know how this keeps happening for us, but somehow it does. And West Ham have Liverpool's number this year. I mean, that's the thing. In two league matches, it's a 3-0 and a 2-0, both in dominating fashion. The 3-0 at Anfield was just a true thumping in every way, shape, and form. And Coutinho actually was sent off in that match. That was the first loss of the season for Liverpool. Back when a man by the name of Brendan Rodgers was the manager. Remember that guy? But yeah, even under Jurgen Klopp, West Ham gave Liverpool a thumping at the Bowling Ground 2-0. So it should be interesting to see how they match up a third time this in the cup competition. Cannot wait for that this week in Liverpool and West Ham. All right, I have to ask you though, going back to the atmosphere that you speak of with the Bowling Ground, I kind of want to close on this, looking forward to next season and even years to follow with West Ham, with this massive move into the Olympic Stadium and everything that is going to go with it. And a lot of people starting to throw out the name Tottenham as this big thing for West Ham to overtake, kind of as the third biggest team in London. Right now it would go either, you know, Chelsea or Arsenal, then Spurs, then everybody else. And everybody kind of looking at, wow, with this move into the Olympic Stadium, we could overtake Tottenham. And then from there, who knows where we could go? Maybe people shouldn't get too carried away with that, but there definitely is something to it. So whether, Shaka, it's the atmosphere at the stadium or the money behind all of this and why people are starting to bring that comparison up, what do you think about the move to the Olympic Stadium and what West Ham have to gain from it?
Well, I have to admit, initially I was not in favor of it. I just wondered if taking West Ham away from its traditional home of the Bowling Ground was one that would ultimately backfire. But, you know, saying that, that's just me kind of wanting to see those traditions maintained. But if West Ham are to have any hope of overtaking the likes of Spurs, they have to move into a bigger ground. They have to kind of expand and grow in that way. Now, the challenge would be, and West Ham have always drawn from that East London crowd, and that's their catchment area. Can they cast their net any wider? And I think that's the challenge for the West Ham management to figure out. And if they can, how do they do that? Because as good as the atmosphere is at the Bowling Ground, you know, all of a sudden you're being asked to fill a bigger stadium, even if you just transplant the same numbers and the same faces into this bigger Olympic stadium, a lot might very well be lost. And you know, you have to wonder about that transition and whether West Ham can handle it. But again, right now for me, West Ham need to focus on themselves and getting their crowd into the Olympic stadium. I'm not worried too much about what Spurs are doing, or whether they can catch or equip Tottenham Hotspur. Spurs traditionally have a bigger audience, both locally and internationally. And so therefore, you know, right now, that shouldn't be West Ham's focus. They continue to show the fans that have followed them through thick and thin. And let's also remember that in the years that West Ham were relegated, they were still getting 19, 20,000 coming to the bowling ground, no question, every single week. They have to continue to service those. The club now has to be loyal to them. And I think as you do that, you grow slowly but surely. Why not? And I heard you speaking about the TV deal coming in late from next season. What this does, it doesn't close the gap, but between the haves and the have-nots, and those clubs with bigger commercial machines, but it kind of levels the playing field a little bit. And if West Ham can continue to punch above their weight, as I think they've been doing this season, if they can continue to do that with that lessening of the percentage difference between themselves and the bigger clubs in English football, who knows and why not? But right now, my own initial concern is that the club now has to continue to be loyal to those fans that have been loyal to the club for all these years.
Without a doubt, spoken like a true hammer. Shaka Hislop, always a great pleasure having you on the show. You're welcome back anytime. And next time, we'll be sure to talk a little bit more TNT here on World Soccer Talk Radio.
No problem at all. Always a pleasure, Nate.
Thanks again. Shaka Hislop, Trinidad and Tobago, West Ham, so much more. And check him out on ESPN FC. Huge thank you to Shaka. We're back after this. Closing this thing out, World Soccer Talk Radio, Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. Another huge thank you to Shaka Hislop, and one quote is going to stand out from that entire interview on the great Frank Lampard, who was told he was not good enough for West Ham. And in Shaka's opinion, that helped Frank Lampard develop a work ethic off of rejection and a work ethic that was second to none. Think about the moral of that story. World Soccer Talk Radio signing off. Big one tomorrow. Steve Parrish, the chairman of Crystal Palace, with us right here on Sports Byline. World Soccer Talk Radio, love you. Signing off.